Eliza D., host of How to Save the Planet podcast. How to Save the Planet is where I interview people whose professions and passions have to do with climate change. Now, at this point, long-term listeners might be noticing that this intro is sounding a little bit different from previous episodes. That is because, starting with this episode, I will be recording intros and endings specially made for that episode. So, with us today, we have Deb Music, and here's a little bit about Deb. Deb is originally from New York and Boston and began her career doing early intervention work with children and families. In 2004, Deb relocated to the Seattle area to co-found Theo Chocolate, the nation's first organic and fair trade certified bean-to-bar chocolate maker, with a socially and environmentally responsible mission. Deb then stepped away from Theo in 2018 to dedicate her time and energy to the climate crisis and became a trained climate reality project leader in July of 2020. She's the founder of the soon-to-be-launched Eat Less Meat Pledge. Deb has delivered numerous talks and keynotes at forums ranging from TEDx to the BECU Foundation and has appeared on nationally televised shows, including Top Chef and The Martha Stewart Show. Deb is the author of The Theo Chocolate Cookbook, Recipes and Sweet Treats from Seattle's Favorite Chocolate Maker, published in 2015. Deb holds a BA in philosophy and an MED from Harvard University. Okay, here is Deb Music. Hello and welcome, Deb, to How to Save the Planet.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Yes, thank you for being here. So what do you do and what company did you co-found?
Well, I co-founded a company called Theo Chocolate, which is located in the Fremont neighborhood of Seattle. And Theo is the first organic fair trade bean to bar chocolate factory in North America. And we started back in 2004, it took us about 2 years to build the factory. And then we made our first chocolate bar in 2006. We literally walked it off the production line and up the street to the PCC market in Fremont, where they put it on the shelf, which was a big moment. But Theo was founded awesome. On an educational and social. It was awesome. I'll never forget it. And the company was founded on an educational and social mission to help people start to connect the dots about where their food comes from and some of the climate impacts of the foods they eat. And I grew Theo into a national brand and worked there as part of the leadership team until about 2018, when I decided it was time to do some other things that were really important to me. And also, as a side note, I really needed to stop eating so much sugar on the daily. It was really starting to affect my health. So after a year of rest and recovery and lots of reading, I decided to participate in the Climate Reality Project training in 2020. And I've always been really passionate about food and making healthy food accessible to all people. And so I decided to pivot to full-time climate activism, both focused on moving the needle from our current Western diet to a predominantly plant-based nutrient-dense diet, which I think is inevitable for all of us in order to have a livable future.
Yeah. Well, that's so awesome. I love Theo Chocolate. It's like a staple food in our family.
I love hearing that. That makes my heart happy. I love it too.
Yeah, like I can't even explain. It's so good.
Great.
Yeah. Well, what degrees do you have and where did you go to school?
Well, I went to college and grad school in the 80s, Eliza. So long before you were even born. You can do the math in your head if you really want to. And I have a BA in philosophy and an MED in developmental psychology from Harvard University. And it's funny because it would seem that my career has turned in such a different direction from both of those, you know, content areas. But in fact, they really taught me to think deeply and to understand some things about human nature, which is really applicable to marketing. So.
Wow, that's really interesting. You can like connect philosophy and business. I think that's pretty cool.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's just, I think I'm a good example of a person who really pursued the things that were interesting to me in my studies, and it didn't really prevent me from going into, you know, a much broader career path.
Yeah, that's so awesome. What got you interested in social justice and food systems?
Yeah, I've always been really passionate about food and nutrition, and I was experimenting with vegetarian and vegan diets for many years before they became mainstream. And I've always believed in food as medicine. And the more I've learned, the more I've come to understand how critical our food systems are in perpetuating poverty, oppression of women and girls in the developing world, poisoning our planet, and perpetuating racism. So the climate crisis intersects with every aspect of our food system, and it's broken, and we have a lot of work to do to fix it.
Yeah. What do you think are some things that we can do to fix the food system? That seems like kind of a big question, but what's your take?
It is a really big question. I mean, one of the single most important things we can start to do, and this is because in the Western world, we live in a consumer-driven society, is we can start to create the demand for foods that are healthier and that are plant-based, right? So that's one of the single most important things we can do at the individual level, is really stop eating so much meat. And hopefully we'll talk a little bit more about that. But I think at the individual level, that's really critical. And then, you know, at the systemic level, there's a lot that we can all do to start to support family-owned farms, urban green spaces to provide access to marginalized communities to healthy foods. There's a lot we can be doing at the legislative level. Cory Booker has introduced some legislation to eliminate CAFOs, which are confined animal feeding operations. There are many, many things I think that need to happen on every level. And I think the pandemic has really sort of pulled back the curtain on a lot of what's wrong with our, our food system. So hopefully people are a little bit more aware now. And, you know, there's a lot that needs to happen around shifting of food subsidies, et cetera, because, you know, the world we live in here today, the government is literally paying farmers to grow food that's thrown away. So there's a lot that needs to happen, but I really do like to drive home the point about what we can do as individuals.
Yeah, yeah. For those who don't know, could you explain a little bit why meat is not good for the planet?
Yeah, I mean, you know, simply put, meat and cattle production is, by according to Project Drawdown, it is the fourth largest emitter of greenhouse gas emissions on the planet. And if cattle were a country, they would be the third largest emitter of greenhouse gases after the United States and China. So, and methane, which is the, this, you know, literally cow farts, right? That's cows are farting methane gas, is way more potent than CO2. So for that simple reason, it's really, really critical that we reduce our meat consumption. In addition, we simply don't have enough arable land remaining on the planet to continue with the percentage of meat consumption that exists today. And if, for example, you know, the growing middle class in China started to adjust their diets to consume the amount of meat that's pretty standard for a Western diet, we'd need, like, this isn't the right number, but we'd need something like five more planets to actually satisfy that demand. So, number one, it's practically impossible. It's a lot. And don't quote me on that number. I'm sort of throwing it out off the cuff, but it's a big number. You know, cattle production has, you know, drastically contributed to the deforestation of the Amazon rainforest. The way that we grow our food, even separate from that, is mostly through monocropping. And so we're actively depleting topsoils, which not only reduces the nutrient density of food, but it makes it impossible to continue to grow food on the same piece of land. So for so many reasons, there are so many reasons why we need to adjust our diets and change the way that we grow and produce food.
Yeah. Well, geez, I could be like a vegan now. That's very convincing.
Well, you know what the thing is, and I like to, I think it's great if you want to be a vegan, but I also have thought a lot about this. The vegan movement, and, you know, perhaps unfairly, I'm not really making a comment on whether it's justified or not, but they do kind of have a bad rap, and they can be perceived as sort of militant, again, fairly or unfairly. I'm not suggesting that, because I have on and off been a vegan at many points in my life. I think it's a really big leap to go from the way most people, you know, at least probably that we know, eat to becoming strictly vegan. And I think it's really, really important to, oh, wow, there's a bald eagle soaring outside of my window right now. So I'm sorry.
Oh my gosh.
I know it's the middle of our conversation, but I had to look
no,
at
it's
it.
Okay. Enjoy.
I feel like it's a message. Right? The bald eagle is soaring gracefully in front of me as he's the eagle is confirming the conversation that we're having.
Yeah.
I think that people really need tools to enable them to start to make incremental steps. And again, you know, there's actually a diet called the Harvard Healthy Diet, which was developed, I'm not sure exactly what year it was developed, but it said that in order to really maximize our food intake for health purposes, the most that we need to consume is about 3 ounces of protein a day. And most people who are consuming a Western diet are eating way, way more protein than that. So I think there's a lot of education that could happen for people. And I think just the act of reducing the amount of animal protein that you eat would make a huge difference if we did that collectively as a society. So you don't have to go vegan, but I think changing the way you eat is necessary. Depending on how much meat you eat, how many animal products you eat, it's probably necessary and really important.
Yeah. That's very encouraging.
Okay.
Why did you decide to make Theo chocolate?
Well, that's a great question. And, you know, a large part of the answer is in what I just said to you. We really wanted to start to connect the dots for consumers about where their food comes from, how it's grown, and what happens along the supply chain. So, you know, for example, what happens to the cocoa farmers? How much money do they make? In the conventional cocoa industry, farmers are exposed to really horrible chemical pesticides and fertilizers. The land is, on large plantations, is monocropped, which depletes topsoil and ravages biodiversity. Mm-hmm. In many countries, cocoa farmers earn less than $1 a day. They can't afford to send their children to school. And there are also well-documented reports of child trafficking, child labor and child trafficking in the conventional cocoa industry, particularly in parts of West Africa, like Ghana and the Ivory Coast. So we wanted to pull back the curtain on this food that we love so much, which we ironically share, right, as a celebratory food. It's an expression of love in our culture. And so the idea behind Theo was to start to educate consumers about how to make better choices in the foods they buy, how to, so to speak, vote for better choices with their dollars. And we started a conversation with our customers through our daily public tour program about social justice and environmental degradation in our food system that continues to this day and is more needed now than ever because we're running out of time. You know, we started Theo 20 years ago almost. So, you know, in today's world, we need to be having this conversation about CAFOs, which, you know, we talked a little bit about earlier, confined to animal feeding operations, which are hidden in some of the most rural places in this country, but which are poisoning the land and the surrounding communities, mostly poor communities, predominantly BIPOC communities, every day. And they're some of the absolute worst contributors to greenhouse gas emissions on the planet.
Yeah. Well, that's, I'm so glad that he founded Theo's. It's great. That's, it's a great reason, a great product.
Well, you know what we found too. What we found too, Eliza, and I think you'll probably agree with this, is that chocolate is just a fantastic vehicle for educating people, because we decided to have this.
Oh, public, absolutely.
Right? This public tour program, you come into the factory, we're feeding you chocolate. And while we're feeding you chocolate, yeah, you're listening to a conversation about things that, as it turns out, you might not have known much about, but you genuinely care about. I think people care about these issues when they learn about them. And so it's just a great platform for educating people, because chocolate is, again, it's like a food we really love. So people, I think, are able to access more of an emotional connection to that information when they're eating chocolate than maybe some other foods. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's, yeah, so genius. It's really good. How did you come up with the company name for Theo Chocolate?
Oh, that's a super fun question. So the name Theo comes from Theobroma cacao, which is the Latin genus and species of the cocoa tree. So if you look at our logo, which I have right here, and I know our listeners can't hear it, but the Theo logo has a cacao pod in it. So the O is actually a cacao pod hanging from a branch. And the name of the company is dedicated to the cocoa tree. It's all about the tree.
That's cool. I would have never have guessed. That's awesome.
Yeah, I know. It's a fun fact.
Yeah. What does climate justice mean to you and Theo Chocolate?
Well, I think achieving climate justice means that we live in a world where all people of every race, socioeconomic status, et cetera, have equal access to healthy food, clean air, and clean water, right? The things that we need in order to live a healthy life and thrive. You know, climate justice is a term that's used to frame global warming as an ethical and political issue rather than one that's purely environmental or physical in nature. Climate justice includes issues of equality, human rights, collective rights, and also the historical responsibility for climate change, right? Who needs to be held accountable? And Theo was founded on the belief that we're all connected and that we're all responsible for each other's well-being in this world. And so I think that that idea we had of really connecting the dots for people is very much in alignment with the idea of climate justice.
Yeah. What are you doing now that you've stepped away from Theo and become a Climate Reality Project leader?
Yeah, well, now I'm focused on continuing to educate myself because there's so much to learn. And I'm actively working on launching my Eat Less Meat Pledge, which I think is something you and I have talked about a little bit.
Yeah.
I'm still super passionate about the need for dietary change in order to protect what's left of the planet and heal some of the damage that's already been done. And as I've said many times, a plant-based diet is really necessary for us to achieve that. And I think it's inevitable. And another thing that I'm thinking about doing is writing another cookbook, because I actually wrote a cookbook during the Theo years. But this one would be about cooking nutritious food in a really small place, whether it's van life or live aboard, which is how we refer to people who live on boats or in tiny pod apartments. Because we all need to be reducing our consumption. And I'm connected
to
that's
awesome.
Yeah, you like it?
Yeah, I think it's a great idea.
I'm glad. I mean, I'm connected to a cool community of people who are actively reducing their footprint and living in that way. And my husband and I are sailors, and our fantasy is to outfit a catamaran that is completely solar and electric powered and live aboard it. And so I think a resource like that would be really fun and really useful. So I'm contemplating that right now and kind of putting together a team of collaborators who are just amazing people who are literally like traveling the globe in their van or, you know, living aboard boats. And yeah, so
that's another project.
I'm glad you like it. I'm glad you like it.
Yeah, well, I would totally use that even though I live in a house. Like, yeah.
Well, efficiency.
Yeah. That sounds awesome.
Yeah, finding greater efficiencies, I think, is a great idea for all of us. I mean, just think about it. Even if you live in a house, if you can learn to cook a one pot meal or you can learn to do like a one sheet pan dinner, you know, it's less food waste. It's less cleanup, which means less water use. We all need to be thinking about how to do better.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I guess like out of all of the things that you could have done, why did you decide to put your time and your energy into tackling the climate crisis and food systems?
Well, I think you probably know the answer to that because it's something you're so focused on. The climate crisis is the single biggest existential threat that we all face. And I can't imagine doing anything more important with my time. And I also feel like my generation has a huge responsibility to do all we can to repair a lot of the damage that we have caused, knowingly or unknowingly. And not just watch from the sidelines and applaud while your generation does all of the work. I feel deeply responsible for a lot of the life choices I've made and, you know, the degree to which I've been a consumer and how much I've had my head in the sand, at least for kind of, you know, the earlier years of my life when I was in my, maybe my teens and my 20s. Because I think by the time I was in my mid 30s and certainly by the time I started Theo, I was much, much more aware and I was on this path. But I think there are a lot of people in my generation who have the resources and the time and who have a responsibility to do everything we can to start to reverse some of the damage for you, you know, for my children, for hopefully my future grandchildren, if I'm lucky enough to have a grandchild. I'd be happy with one because I think that population growth is another thing that unfortunately, you know, your generation is going to need to be tackling and thinking about. So I can't imagine doing anything else.
Yeah. Yeah. What advice would you give to folks going into the organic food business?
Well, this is a big question. I mean, I would say, you know, given the point, you know, where we are right in at this moment in time, that knowing your supply chain and making sure that it's number one, responsible, that it's environmentally sound and that it's stable, which includes understanding the impacts of climate change on it, are really, really important. You know, if you're going to make an organic food product, you have to be able to source ingredients for whatever you're making. So really going deep and understanding the impacts of the supply chain. That's like, you know, from the climate perspective, I would say it's really important to do that because let's face it, we have a lot of choices already where we live here in terms of food. You know, I have European friends who, when they come stay with us, which of course hasn't happened in the last year, but they walk into a Whole Foods and their jaws are on the floor, you know, just because of the variety that we have, you know, the abundance of products. So I would say, you know, really think about that. And then I would say, understand your category. Are you creating a product that will be additive or is it just another brand of something that's already readily available to consumers? Because it's much harder to succeed if you're entering into a crowded category. So really understand whatever your unique value proposition is. Does that make sense to you? Because I know now I'm getting into a little bit of food, business speak. And then also know your story. Like in today's world, consumers want to know who and what is behind a brand. They want to know what the brand's values are. So make sure you've got real clarity on that, and you can share it in a way that will resonate with your target audience, with your desired customers. I remember when in like the first 5 years of Theo, when we had really started to get gain some success and traction in the market, and people were so excited about the brand because of the story that we were telling, and the transparency in our supply chain. And I had another friend who had started a food company here in Seattle, which ended up being very successful. But he said to me, we want to be more like you guys. And I said, well, you can't be more like us. You can't be more like Theo. You have to be more like you. You have to figure out what the story of your brand is and just be better about telling people that story. And they did have a great story and they did do that and they were very successful. So that whole idea of kind of know your story, really understand what you're doing, why you're doing it, what purpose is it going to serve, what kind of contribution is it going to make? Because at this point in time, I don't feel like we need to, this is just me, but I don't feel like we need to be feeding our consumer habits. I feel like we need to really be focusing on shifting the paradigm away from endless consumption and growth and start to understand how to kind of press pause and reset things so that we can preserve what we have, what remains, and heal a lot of the damage that's already been done.
I'm at a loss for words.
I know. It's a lot. It's a heavy time, you know? Also maintain sense of humor. Yeah. That's a big one, Eliza. Maintain sense of humor always.
That is it for today. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of How to Save the Planet. I really appreciate it. I hope that you enjoyed it as much as I did. And make sure to follow or subscribe this podcast so you don't miss out on any new episodes. See you next time.